You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, May 16th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor Kim Phillips Fine, author of Fear City: New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics. Also on the program today, Donald Trump accused of giving top secret info to Russians in order to make his pee-pee seem bigger.
You have briefing book. You are a great man.
Yes, I am a great man.
They give you papers? Oh, my gosh.
They don't give black president paper. They give it to you within a couple weeks.
You're a real man. What color paper do they give you? Can we see? Following their ongoing attempts of destroying the Affordable Care Act, Republicans now looking to slash more funding for those living in poverty. Republicans in Senate want to, I should say, conservatives in Senate want to nuke the reconciliation rules. Trump and Republicans expanding the abortion gag rule will hurt AIDS, malaria, other medical services, particularly in Africa. And a big money, a Russian money laundering case is settled. Records forever sealed. Lastly, an award-winning journalist, Javier Valdez, shot to death in Mexico. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. So General McMaster's just had another press briefing to argue that, well, what Donald Trump did was not a big deal. And I don't know. I mean, what's clear is this was not the plan. That's the one thing you can be clear. I mean, they didn't break any laws, arguably broke the oath he took of office. Not terribly relevant until the Republicans decide that they've got enough tax cuts and cuts to benefits for middle class and people living in poverty. But the one thing that's clear is this was not the plan.
No, I don't think that was ever the game plan.
Donald Trump just shooting off the hip, maybe one of those awkward silences. You don't know what to say when you're seeing, you know, you're reunited with your buddies after a long time.
That would actually be a great tactic in general with him, just filling the awkward silence. It's like, so it's nice here in Washington.
You know,
hey guys, look at
we just found secret intelligence about
you. But yeah, anything Syria, Iran, whatever.
I mean, what was the quote? The quote was, I mean, I have it here somewhere, but I'm not. The quote was something like, "I get great intelligence. We have the best intelligence. They bring it to me every day." I mean, it's like
he is so breathtakingly moronic.
Yeah, some people say it's stupidity, but I really do think like untreated syphilis is moving to the forefront of most obvious explanation for this guy's behavior.
Me.
I mean, it's just absurd and obscene, and it is, do not forget this, it is enabled every single day by Paul Ryan.
And he doesn't have the syphilis excuse.
And let me repeat what I said on Twitter last night, too, was I don't care if you're a never-Trumper. If you supported Mitt Romney when he went and made Donald Trump a kingmaker in 2012. If you didn't complain about John Boehner not telling members of his caucus, hey, cut it out with this, you know, birtherism and introducing laws to promote birtherism. If you didn't have a problem with John McCain picking Sarah Palin, then I don't give an F what you're saying today. Honestly. Donald Trump is your creation. And Ben Shapiro wrote back, well, Hillary Clinton, we blame you then for Hillary Clinton not beating him. And I said, and I did. I apologize for not being able to defeat the monster you created. That your entire professional life has been dedicated to bringing about in one form or another. It just so happened maybe you were on the wrong side of his largesse. And so you decided to go on to another side. But give me a break. This is what they built this. They want credit for it. They built it. And all of those people. John McCain picking Sarah Palin. The idea that he's not reminded of that every time he goes on to the Saturday morning or Sunday morning talk shows. You know, you could do it politely. You just frame the question like, Senator McCain, you have a real problem with Donald Trump, even though you picked Sarah Palin, who was the prototype for Donald Trump's entire politics. What is your thoughts on what Trump did? I mean, you could just work it in like that. If it's Sunday morning, it's Meet the Press with Senator John McCain, the guy who picked Sarah Palin. That's all the way you didn't do.
Very polite.
He's a maverick. He might not come back.
Right.
I thought they were very rude to you.
My
You're
God.
My favorite man ever.
So, Saul, of course, was up until 11:30 last night.
Are you serious?
I am really? Totally serious. And it was... This happens three times a week, I would say now. Saul is lying there. I am like literally have to put the full weight of my arm across his body to keep him from getting up at 11 o'clock because I am now falling asleep in his bed, which, as you know, is the most comfortable bed in my house. Why? Because the Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress. It also just happens to be available at a shockingly fair price. Supportive memory foam create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. And here's the best part. You try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. What? That's crazy. I'm used to going to a mattress store and spending 30 seconds on it before I get kicked out of there. If you don't love it, they'll pick it up and refund you everything, everything. Casper understands the importance of truly sleeping on a mattress before you commit, especially considering you're going to spend a third of your life on it. Unless you have children, in that case, it's probably going to be like 1/18. Free shipping and returns to U.S. and Canada. What? In Canada? You better order a lot of them up there because I have a feeling you're going to have some house guests soon. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars, it's quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. Get $50 toward any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/majority and using the offer code majority. You go to casper.com/majority, use the offer code majority, get $50 off. Terms and conditions apply. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be talking to professor of history at New York's University Gallatin School of Individualized Study, Kim Phillips Fine, on Fear City, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Kim Phillips Fine. She is a professor of history at New York University's Gallatin School of Individualized Study, written for The Nation, Dissent, The Baffler, Atlantic, The New York Times, author of her latest book, Fear City, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics. Welcome to the program, Kim.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is fascinating stuff for me, partly because I remember this era from afar and from visiting New York at that time, having had been born there a little bit before this era. And also, I just recently watched an Adam Curtis film where he talks about this era in not with nearly the depth, obviously, that you've covered here, but with a similar disposition towards what happened. And why don't you give us a sense of what New York was like? Let's start with like in the mid to late 60s, because I think people don't realize how successful New York was for a city this size to be middle class at that time.
Right. I think that's really true. People don't remember or the ways in which New York, which is now, you know, well known as a pretty difficult place to live as a middle class person, but the ways in which it was much easier in the middle years of the 20th century. So New York in the middle years of the 20th century had a kind of extensive, almost like a local welfare state, or kind of an extensive and generous public sector. It had the tuition was free at the city university system, which was expanding during the 40s, 50s, and 60s. The public school system was, there was no question that it was mixed, but there was a certain, the way today public schools rely very heavily on the kind of contributions and fundraising of parents to provide all kinds of extracurricular activities. That really wasn't the case then. There was remarkable funding for art and music education in the city's public schools. The mass transit system was, you know, extensive and also quite low cost in comparison to the rising fares and service problems of today. And the city as a whole had a kind of, there was a very high labor union. The labor unions were quite powerful in the city at this time. There was a certain kind of egalitarian ethos in the culture of the city through from the end of the New Deal years going into the 40s, 50s, and early 60s.
And you had there was also, you know, I mean, at least some very major projects for middle class housing. Right, like Peter
right,
Cooper Village and or Stuyvesant Town and others around the city. Go ahead.
Yeah, there were kind of major middle class housing developments, as well as a kind of expansion. This is the expansion, the construction and expansion of public housing in the city, which was, you know, although it kind of wound up being increasingly for low income residents. I think the initial vision was that it wouldn't be as much a kind of concentration of poor people, but that it was a kind of expansion of the inexpensive housing stock in the city, something that was really, you know, remarkable by the standards of today.
And we should also say that the number of sort of intellectual luminaries and government luminaries that came out of City College, educated for free, you know, almost defined the generation in some respects.
Yeah, no, I mean, City College was, and really not, I think it's, you know, City College was, kind of extraordinary educational institution, and really the whole City University of New York system, which was, I think it's also, it wasn't just the kind of flagship schools of City College, Brooklyn College, but the sort of expansion of the system during the 50s and 60s, that is really remarkable. The creation of the community colleges. I would also mention, actually, the public health resources of the city. The city had a kind of a very dynamic public health department. It operated more than 20 at the peak municipal hospitals. There were primary care clinics throughout the city as well. There was also actually an effort to create and then to expand city-subsidized daycare for low-income people, for working-class and low-income people. This network of daycares also grew during the 1960s.
So then what happens? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think so. The expansion of the city's public sector over these years, and I should say actually also, you know, there is this kind of tradition of public works, which begins during the 1930s. And is the kind of heavily financed by federal funds coming from the kind of New Deal public works programs and projects. And this tradition of public works, of building parks, swimming pools, and the like, this continues during the 40s and 50s as well. So the entire, there is a kind of growing tension about the size and scope of the city's public sector, which intensifies during the 1960s. There are many people in the city's business and financial elites who are critical of the city's spending on these programs. And their criticism comes partly from anxiety about paying higher taxes, but it also, I think, reflects a certain sense of the political contest over the city, the question of whose voice matters, whose voice counts. Because I think, you know, the expansion of the city's public sector doesn't just happen. It happens in part in response to community pressure, to organizing among poor people, organizing among people of color in New York during the 60s, the kind of the civil rights and black freedom movements in the North and in New York in particular are part of the impetus for the growth of the city's public sector. And so there's a way in which there's a struggle, a sense that it's a contest over the city's future. One example of this comes in 1966 when there is a proposal to impose a stock transfer tax. So this will kind of like take a small tax every time a stock certificate changes hands. The New York Stock Exchange actually at this point threatens to move out of New York altogether, going to either Connecticut or there was some brief discussion of moving to a city in California. So this is a kind of, and this was seriously discussed. It wasn't just a threat, although it was, you know, partly that, but it was seriously discussed within the stock exchange. Should we move out of New York? So there's an intensifying conflict, I think, over the future of the city and a sense that there's whose voice matters, whose voice counts. This comes at the same time that New York enters into a recession, which is kind of steeper in New York in the early 70s than elsewhere in the country. There's the city loses hundreds of thousands of jobs over this period. This is a kind of onset of deindustrialization in New York and also of white flight and the departure of middle class people in the city for the surrounding suburbs. So the city also, at the same time, its revenue base is becoming strained at the very moment when there is a increased demand for social services.
How much of the recession was a function of the oil shocks that we had? I mean, I guess that doesn't come till 73,
yeah.
But what were the sort of the major causes of the recession in New York in particular?
Yeah, well, the oil shocks, you know, certainly don't, they place a deep weight on, you know, a burden on city finances, and they are problematic for the city as they are for the country as a whole. But I think it's not just that in New York. It's also a longer term, you know, the deindustrialization of the city, which is both a, you know, it's both kind of companies are leaving the city for places which have you know, weaker unions where they can pay lower wages. Also, cheaper land is a factor. And then finally, the city government is, I think, ambivalent about the presence of manufacturing. There's a long sense that it would be better for real estate values if parts of Manhattan had less industry and were more zoned for residential and commercial development. So, you know, there's a sense in parts of the Lindsay administration, for example, Lindsay being the mayor in the late 1960s, that it would be better to move there'd be more manufacturing, at least in the outer boroughs and not in the central, you know, in Manhattan itself. So there is, you know, city policy is very split about the desirability of maintaining the industrial base. So there's a kind of combination of push and pull factors which really affect the city's manufacturing base in particular. And the city, yes, I think that it's not just the oil shock. There's kind of a deeper structural change taking place in the nature of the city's economy at this moment. At the same time, I think that the flight to the suburbs is also very important. And
that's almost like a national ethos, right?
Yeah,
this idea of like we can go get that picket fence, and that's what we always dreamed of, and that's what everybody's attempting, you know, wanting to do at that point. And so we have this these massive budget shortfalls.
Right, which start to emerge in the late 60s and early 70s.
And
New York is always dependent. I mean, this came up, you know, recently in the fight over who would pay for universal pre-kindergarten in New York. But New York, the city government, depends on Albany to extend taxing power and authority. And so in the late 60s, every year, the mayor is going to Albany asking for new taxing powers. People in Albany are reluctant to extend these. They do so somewhat, but rarely as much as he wants them to. And instead, what happens, the city turns to borrowing and starts to borrow more and more money to fund its operating budget, borrowing, you know, taking out short-term loans, which carry high interest rates and thus kind of exacerbate the fiscal problems that it's getting into.
And let me just be explicit for people who are not familiar with this dynamic in New York.
Okay.
You've got New York City, which is essentially, you know, throwing off all of this money, tax money, from people who live here and from industries that are here, but they don't have direct access to it, at least to a large amount of it, because it's going to the state. And so a lot of that money filters throughout the state, which is far more rural and less, I guess, has less of an ability of generating income. So you've got to basically, you generate this income in New York, but then you've got to go up to Albany and deal with a whole state of a huge state of politicians who have some resentment towards New York and, you know, and particularly probably more so then, don't want necessarily that money to stay in New York.
Yeah, there's a kind of fierce contest over who will actually get to keep the, you know, in a sense, the city is generating its revenue. I mean, this is also true, you know, another thing that's happening in the late 60s is that the war on poverty and the Great Society programs, especially the creation of Medicaid and Medicare and the expansion of welfare spending, these are all programs that are coming from the federal level. And there's kind of a big, you know, under the Johnson administration, there's a big commitment of federal resources to anti-poverty efforts in one way or another. And that money stops growing in the early 1970s. It's kind of the beginning of the end of the war on poverty. And in a way, it leaves cities like New York in this kind of in this bind. They've recently extended these promises to citizens. There is a kind of energized, mobilized population that has a new sense of a kind of set of social rights. And at the same time, the money from the federal government that had appeared to be available to expand this is starting to contract. So, you know, what do you do? What happens?
Well, so then New York finds itself unable to close its budget gap. It is
right.
Facing bankruptcy, and New York as a city approaches the then Ford administration, because Nixon is now exited stage helicopter, I guess. And the Ford administration, the people who address this question are some of, in my estimation, when we talk about the villains of the 20th and still ongoing century, I mean, this is, you know, when you contemplate the players in your in your story, and including Donald Trump, who also is part of this story in some capacity, at least if not metaphorically, I mean literally as well. But the fact that these people are still around and what they have done to our politics and to our country is really astonishing. And I'm talking about Alan Greenspan, Donald Rumsfeld, who else was around Ford, basically saying, and this is when Greenspan, too, was still, smoking cigarettes with Ayn Rand, right? I mean,
right. He's shortly kind of fresh out of the scene, the Ayn Rand inner circle at that moment. Yes, he's the chairman of Ford's Council of Economic Advisors. And Donald Rumsfeld at this moment is Ford's chief of staff. He will become Secretary of Defense, but during the fiscal crisis moment, that hasn't happened quite yet. Actually, Dick Cheney is another kind of close advisor of Ford's, although he was less central to my particular story, but he's definitely in that mix of people. And yes, one of the things that was really shocking to me in working on this book and in working in the Ford archives was seeing just how willing Ford's inner circle was to allow New York to go bankrupt. There is a sense of that the city has brought its problems on itself, that it is to blame alone, that if New York goes bankrupt, it really won't matter very much for the rest of the national economy or for cities or states around the rest of the nation. There is a sense of that a default in New York might actually be a good thing because it would teach other cities a lesson about the dangers of social spending, and a kind of willingness to entertain what to many people appeared an unthinkable disaster. And to kind of play with this and flirt with it and to promote it almost.
Isn't it racialized too? Isn't it highly racialized? The idea, and this is, I think, from around the time, it wasn't until 9/11 really that New York sort of became part of America again, I think, for a lot of people across the country. And that was because it was, John Rocker, when he came up here, that baseball player, right, was talking about, the freaks and the blacks and the gays going on the subway. I mean, that to me seems like the perspective that the country had. And it was like, it was almost as if the Ford administration was saying, like, if you're going to offer this many services to your black and Puerto Rican citizens, this is what you're going to get.
Right. Well, I think that is, there's a sense of, you don't always find them expressing it quite that openly, but I think there is a sense that this is that there's a sense of kind of offering excessively generous programs to people who don't really deserve them. And that that's the, and that if you do that, don't look to the federal government for help if you get into trouble. I should say another person that was kind of really driving this line in the Ford administration was William Simon, who was Ford's Treasury Secretary. And Simon actually himself came out of municipal bond circles in New York. He was a very wealthy man with a large estate in New Jersey. And he had, kind of been one of the players. The banks, the financial community as a whole in New York was happy to finance the city's expansion of debt. The rating agencies, kind of said everything was completely fine. They really were supportive of the city's borrowing right up until the moment when they wouldn't any longer. They were very complicit, I think, in the city's taking on as much debt, as much short-term debt as it did. And yet, there was a sense that the federal government would, and Simon, as part of this, was really pushing.
What was behind that? I mean, there's a great scene in that Adam Curtis film, Hypernormalization, where they show the footage of that day where they have, like, the whatever it was, the weekly or bi-monthly sale of New York City bonds, and nobody shows up. And they've got they cancel it at 11 in the morning or wherever it was. Right. And they say, oh, we're coming back at 3 p.m. And they come back at 3 p.m. and nobody shows up. I mean, what caused that decision? I mean, was there I mean, clearly all the banks knew that each other wasn't going to show up that day.
Right, right, right.
What caused that?
Right. Well, I think that the, you know, in the over the course of the winter of 1970, kind of the early January, February, March 1975, the banks were becoming increasingly anxious about the city's finances, and there were a couple of particular events that made them concerned. There was a state agency that almost defaulted on its debt as well, the Urban Development Corporation, which had been responsible for building the Marcus Garvey project and also the kind of a lot of the construction on Roosevelt Island. Its near bankruptcy sets off a kind of wave of fear in the city's financial community. There's also this, you know, there's like a kind of changing of the guard. There are a lot of young people in their kind of 30s and 40s who play a really important role in kind of setting off alarm bells in the financial community. And so one of the banks that handled or that was part of these groups that would underwrite the city's debt, meaning take it and sell it to investors around the country, he was placed on the municipal bond desk. He wasn't usually there. Someone was sick and he came in and had to be there. So he was the one who had to sign the paperwork. And he brought in a different law firm that wasn't accustomed to handling the city deals. And the lawyers from this new firm said, you know, is the city really going to collect all of the property taxes it says it will? Can you ask for data to this effect? So he asked for data. Nobody had done this, you know, before, and the city didn't have the data ready, so his bank pulled out of the deal. And it was like this kind of thing that sets off the alarm bells and that starts, you know, and that leads to that meeting where...
So a fluke, almost.
The underwriters don't show up. I mean, or the banks, you know, don't want to make an offer on the debt. And I think actually with that day, they did, you know, there was a big negotiation. They wound up agreeing to finance it one more time, but the writing is on the wall. And, you know, I think they become afraid that continuing to market the city's debt will, when it's not, you know, when the city's finances are in this kind of disarray, that they'll wind up, you know, kind of taking huge losses on it in the end, and they also might wind up in a difficult legal position because of selling it to investors around the country. And I think that's why they stop being willing to do it.
So in comes Felix Rohatyn, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly. And what happens next? Essentially, is it that Congress makes a, I mean, you know, so much of what we're talking about, you sort of see play out with Detroit on some level.
Right.
But tell us what happens now. 'Cause basically, and I guess this is also what you would see with like the IMF going into some third world country and saying, you know, we're going to give you loans to buy, you know, hydroelectric power or dams, and you do that, and then all of a sudden you're broke, and then we're going to start taking some of your natural resources, and we're going to, you know, that telecommunications company that your government owns, we're going to own that now, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, it's interesting. It does have a certain resemblance to that kind of situation. I mean, what happens in New York is that for the rest of 1975, the city is on the edge of bankruptcy, and bankruptcy, the idea of bankruptcy, although people in the Ford administration are very blasé about it, within the city and really around the world, the idea of New York's bankruptcy sets off a lot of fear. There's a lot of uncertain, you know, people don't know what bankruptcy will mean. They don't know what services will be cut, which will be maintained. You know, when a city goes bankrupt, it's not like a corporation going bankrupt. You can't just kind of sell off the parts of it. You know, you actually have to continue to provide services of some sort for the people who live there. You can't just kind of shut it down. So there's a great deal of uncertainty and fear about what will happen if New York goes bankrupt. And there are a couple of, you know, what winds up happening is that the state creates these agencies that are able to take control over New York's budget and also refinance its debt. and to kind of enforce that the city go on a march towards restructuring its finances and closing down, kind of laying off city workers, closing down hospitals, rescaling its services and changing what it actually is providing to New Yorkers. And this is viewed at the time as very symbolic, part of what New York has to do, as Rohatyn and others say at the time, is make it clear to the national banking community that the city is changing its ways, that it is, you know, so things like, for example, charging tuition at CUNY, that becomes a very important demand, because not only because it will raise money for CUNY, but also and centrally because it will send a signal to the rest of the country that New York is no longer going to be financing these kinds of generous services, and that it is kind of reorienting itself towards business and the business community.
In its most obvious form, I mean, that's why this is just like a clearly a political decision, but it's also gross.
I think there's something very undemocratic about it. I mean, I think one of the things that's, you know, miracle of the fiscal crisis moment is that, you know, the people who are most directly affected by this transformation don't really get to have a say about it. And that was another thing that was very interesting to me working on this story, is how much popular resistance there is to the budget cutting that takes place. So people, there are these kind of protests spring up all around the city. There are people who occupy and sleep in, you know, libraries that are threatened with closure. There are people who kind of have extended campaigns, writing letters to city officials and demonstrating, and also doing sit-ins at CUNY campuses that are supposed to be merged out of existence. Most famously, there's a firehouse in Williamsburg, actually, now a kind of very fancy neighborhood, but at that point, a working-class Polish neighborhood, Polish and Italian, and people from this neighborhood actually occupy the local firehouse and sleep in it for 16 months, demanding that it be kept open and that their neighborhood, you know, which was composed of many wood frame houses that were highly flammable, that did not lose the fire protection that people were relying on. So there is a kind of mass, there's a large and diverse popular resistance to the budget cutting that is, you know, even though that's people are not permitted to attend or be part of the actual decision making bodies, there is this sort of, you know, wave of protest against the changes.
And then what happens? I mean, let's talk a little bit about Trump here, because this is a good example,
right, yeah,
of sort of like these huge giveaways. And let me just, I'm obligated to do this, is to remind people that in particularly in this deal that you were going to talk about with the Commodore Hotel, but also like the next three or four, five deals, well into his 30s, when he signs that contract for this deal, it is co-signed by his dad, and none of it would have happened unless his dad co-signs it, because they're not interested in Donald Trump. They don't know him from anybody. It's Fred Trump,
right,
that is guaranteeing these deals. But that said, please continue.
I actually didn't know that about his father, but I think, yeah, Donald Trump was at this point, you know, he was a young man in his late 20s. And his, you know, he's mostly known, as you point out, as the son of Fred Trump, who's a, you know, an outer borough landlord and developer, owning tens of thousands of apartments in Brooklyn and Queens. And Donald Trump wants to get into Manhattan real estate and becomes involved in a deal around the Commodore Hotel, which is itself a nearly bankrupt hotel. It was owned by the Penn Central Railroad, which had failed in 1970, and it was near Grand Central Terminal. It had been kind of a grand old hotel from the early 20th century, and that was going to shut down. And the city was afraid of a kind of, you know, a large abandoned building right there near Grand Central. And what Trump proposed was to work with the Hyatt Corporation and to redevelop the hotel through somewhat complex. He would buy it and then kind of lease it, sell it to a state agency and lease it back, and thus avoid paying property taxes or pay reduced property taxes on it. According to a New York Times story from the end of last year, Trump and Hyatt, through this deal, have saved upward of $350 million in property taxes. And you might look at this situation and say, this is bizarre. Why would New York City, at a moment when it actually needs revenue, why would it enter into this arrangement where it is, you know, kind of voluntarily saying we will forego all this revenue for years and years and years to come? But the city actually, you know, and I think this is the other sort of important point about it, is that, you know, a lot of people look at this and say, well, Trump is just, you know, being a canny exploiter here and taking advantage of this prostrate city at this moment. But actually, the city government really promotes and extols the Commodore deal and says that this is its way of sending a signal to the whole business community that the attitude of the city has changed and it's now going to be much more open to business and to development. And yes, it's kind of the first of a wave of different different deals and kind of the whole idea of using city finances to subsidize corporate development, which really kind of takes off after this point in the 1980s. So I think what's, you know, what's interesting is that Trump's rise here is not just a kind of matter of his own will or exertion or something. It's really, you know, something that's undertaken with the support of the city's ostensibly liberal establishment.
Right. And how much in kickbacks did Trump and his father have to give to that state agency to get them to buy it so that he could avoid paying taxes?
I don't know what they, I'm not sure what they had to give and what they did in terms of.
There was a lot of massaging, according at least to the late Wayne Barrett's reporting.
Right.
And I think David K. Johnson has done this, and there's a couple of bios out there.
And
so what happens after this? So you've now got a city that has dramatically cut its services for those living in poverty, for those really the middle class. It is rolling back things like rent control over the next 30 years, I guess. And I mean, to the point where now Manhattan in particular, but just even as it spreads out, is really just seems to be like some type of safety deposit box for the fortunes of oligarchs from Russia and Latin America.
Yeah, well, I think this is, I don't think it's the city, I don't think the fiscal crisis is the only thing that happens or is the only, you know, the only reason that we've kind of arrived at the place we are today where New York is this hyper unequal space and city. But it definitely, you know, it's one of the events that happens that helps make that turn possible and has led to the state of affairs that we are currently in now. You know, that said, I think another kind of interesting and maybe somewhat, you know, counterintuitive thing about the story of the fiscal crisis is that it is interesting to me how much, you know, there were these very deep cuts and there also is this reorientation in city policy and the kind of the growing power of the very rich in New York. But at the same time, it is also remarkable many of the city's public institutions actually are able to survive the crisis. You know, City University, the CUNY still exists, even though there is tuition for it now. There is the city's public transit system is still present and still vital, despite you know, kind of a lack of investment, and even though it's gotten much more expensive to ride. Even public housing, you know, there's some of the most, you know, public housing endures even in some of the wealthiest parts of the city where I'm sure developers would love to get their hands on it. There is a way in which, you know, I think New York still embodies a public ethos or spirit that is, you know, maybe in contest with the hyper inequality of the city, but it is still, you know, is still there and maybe can offer some counter to it as well.
What can you, and I know it's difficult when you're dealing with like counterfactuals, but let's just say it was Johnson in office in 73, for lack of a better substitute. And it wasn't Ayn Randian, Chicago, University of Chicago types who wanted to basically, whip New York into shape with the purse strings that they were holding from the federal government. Give me a sense of what alternatively could have happened in terms of, like, could the U.S. government simply provided the liquidity that New York wanted? And would there have been a way for New York to maintain? I mean, it's true, these institutions remain, but they're fundamentally different in terms of what they do, in terms of who they serve and to what extent they serve and how much they impact people's quality of life. So what would the alternative vision look like?
Right. Well, I think there's, I would say that there are two things. First is that I think, yes, had the federal government been more willing to discuss different financing options for the city, the kind of high drama that surrounded New York's finances over the rest of the year could really have been minimized. Part of the kind of the intensity of the fiscal crisis came from the fact that people knew that there wasn't federal support for the city and that bankruptcy was possible. And that was kind of part of what created this supercharged atmosphere in which it was possible to insist on all of these different kinds of cuts. So if the federal government had said, you know, yes, we will, we're not going to let New York go bankrupt. That's our fundamental, we will start from that premise and we will work from there and we will find some way to enable the city to refinance its debt. You know, I think that would have actually created a very different mood and spirit and
leverage
kind of framework and leverage. Yeah,
different
exactly.
Leverage for the city when it comes to those real estate developers. You just don't get these sweetheart deals. You'll get a decent deal, but
in the same way.
Right. Well,
and I think also, this is a little bit, there are a lot of ways in which changes in federal policy would have been able to affect the city's finances. So, for example, one of the intense burdens that the city had to bear was Medicaid spending, which in New York State, this is a little bit kind of policy wonky, but in New York, Medicaid is split between the federal and state governments, and then the amount that localities bear, or the amount that cities bear, differs from state to state. So New York, in New York, that split between the state government and cities is almost 50-50. So New York is bearing a full 25% roughly of its Medicaid and welfare bills. This is very, very high, much higher than anywhere else in the country. So kind of renegotiating these kinds of splits would also have made a big difference in the city's finances and maybe would have enabled it to continue the kinds of policies that it was pursuing. And then finally, I think just the idea that I think this is where, my book is differs from some of the other accounts of the period. A sense that what the city was, the basic vision that New York had was not, was not foolish, was not stupid, was not kind of, at its core, just giving things away to people who don't deserve them, but that the city actually was trying to, in one way or another, promote a more equal, more just urban space and society, and to kind of address problems of racial and economic inequality that didn't originate in New York, but that that the city had to was actually addressing and coping with those. So some sense the federal government was also committed to that program, committed to that policy and to that agenda. And that the programs the city was financing actually mattered and were, were reasonable attempt. There was nothing inherently unreasonable about them, which is what the attitude that the Ford administration and many conservatives and in truth, over time, many Democrats as well would kind of take that position. But I think that is actually the real tragedy of the story is that, those kinds of programs actually mattered and made a difference. And, in a way, although there's a lot of things that you wouldn't want to go back to in 1970s New York. It's interesting that some of the things the city did are now being talked about again. Things like free college tuition.
Or UPK, which I think is UPK, a little slight exactly. derivation, but indeed.
Right. They kind of executed in a different way, but some, you know, it's more expansive now than it was in the 60s. But still, like that idea, those ideas are now coming back. And I actually think there's much, much to be learned from that moment and from that ethos and spirit. And so that's where I think, in a way, the federal government could have made an even bigger difference. And, you know, that there was actually, in a way, I think this is a story about how questions about politics and values and the question of what kind of society we want to live in, what we owe to each other, can we, as the, you know, wealthiest country in the world, can we afford libraries, music and art in our schools to pay our public sector servants a decent wage? Or do we say those things, you know, are not important? What matters more is tax breaks for developers and military spending.
Right.
So I think that's the kind of question that this book asks.
I hate to be a corrective, but it's almost not can we afford, it's do we want to? And that's what that was answered. I also have to just add that Medicaid split that you talked about with New York mm-hmm. was actually the subject of John Faso and Collins's two Republican congressmen from upstate New York. That's how they got the ACA repeal passed. They were bought off with this notion that the state would absorb more Medicaid payments and therefore their districts would have less of a tax burden. But that's just a sidelight. Kim Phillips Fine, thank you so much for your time today. The book is Fear City, New York's Fiscal Crisis and the Rise of Austerity Politics. We will link to it at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Got to take a quick break, head into the fun half, important story about, you know, how we get here. It is really, I think I read somewhere that Naomi Klein said this was the chapter of shock doctrine that she had missed, essentially. And a very similar situation. We hold the purse strings. We're going to decide to impose austerity on you and basically extract the value that would otherwise go to a broader number of people and narrow that and just give it to guys like Donald Trump and Fed Trump. I mean, that's basically the story, right? That $360 million of tax revenue from that could have gone into services, could have paid for some people to go to college for free. And that same story plays out over the city many, 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 many times. Because remember, Congress still provided relief for the city. It's just that money ended up basically funding the tax cut for Donald Trump to have his daddy co-sign on the Commodore Hotel deal.
And like, yeah, and that's the story across all of the structural readjustment programs in Latin America, Africa, Asia. They put up the money. And then you have to privatize public services and you have to allow public assets to basically be co-invested in with like local oligarchs and multinationals.
I mean, we saw a lot of this with Greece too, right? And it was just, we keep loaning you. Yeah, it's far more severe.
More brutal.
More severe.
And Argentina.
But the dynamic is the same. All right, we're going to take a break. Speaking of dynamic, we're going to move into the dynamic fun half of the program, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, I thought you were just going to say the dynamic half. Got a full name change.
No, we're not going to go that far.
The dynamic half.
It's going to be so
dynamic
today.
My back problems, my sleep, my shoes.
My shoes?
Well, that's another.
I also want to say...
Your shoes are a source of controversy, but that's more with Kelly than me.
Kimberly Phillips Fine has another book called The Invisible Hands, which is on the right wing's reaction to the New Deal. That also looks interesting.
That does look interesting.
Yeah, it goes into DuPont's it mentions in the...
Dude, play those other Pompeii that I gave you. Don't play that one again. I can tell which one he's going
to
do.
I'd just like to point out, if others could see the shoes, they might be a source of controversy.
Well,
amongst others.
All right, maybe we'll do that. Maybe we'll make that. Maybe we'll make that a members' feature. Is this the 222s?
Controversy with anyone with taste.
What? Do the 222s one. I made the trouble of downloading it and copying it. Folks, look, it's in the Dropbox, dude. Yeah, I put it in the Dropbox. I sent you a link.
You really didn't get enough sleep. Oh my God.
God. All right, forget it. Folks.
Sorry, I took too much drugs, man. I was listening to too many high-speed audiobooks and fucking doing
to
drugs.
To index La Poupée, sorry.
Sorry, dude.
I took too much drugs
and listened to Nixon, man. I don't have time for your bad stalker songs covers from the 70s. Sorry, dude.
From the 60s.
Whatever.
All right, folks,
listen.
I didn't
get to the 60s yet.
Your support makes this show possible. I really appreciate some of our members, you know, chipped in with because of the YouTube thing. But if you're a YouTube viewer and you watch the show live on a regular basis, think about heading over to our Patreon. But if you are one of our members who listens to the podcast, or you listen to the freebie show, you want access to the Fun Half, become a member. As a bonus, we give you access to the entire phone, a Fun Half. If you are someone who can't afford it, but you do want to listen, send us an email. Majority Reporters, have a little patience. I'm always weekly, bi-weekly. I'm always behind on the emails in getting to you, but we will get there. Also, we should say, I think I can officially announce it since we screened it last Friday, members are going to get a super bonus material. And that is going to be access to the behind the scenes. It's like 15, 20 minutes long. Behind the scenes of our first live show. And there's a lot of drama in it. I will tell you that right now. You will laugh. You will cry. You will get nervous because there's some tense moments. All that just for becoming a member today. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Also, if you purchase your items through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com, we get a kickback. Also, you will find there, if you happen to be a Jet purchaser, same deal. You will notice no difference. Just head over to majorityreportkickback.com for that link. All right. 646-257-3920. See you in the Fun Half.
She is the dog. say yes.